from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, Emmy Award-winning journalist Leslie Stahl was a CBS News White House correspondent and then spent 25 years as a correspondent and co-editor with 60 Minutes. She covered Watergate, interviewed Margaret Thatcher, and reported from inside Guantanamo Bay. She'll join us next to reflect on her career, the changing face of media, and the joy of becoming a grandmother, which she chronicles in her new book, Becoming Grandma. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Emmy Award-winning journalist Leslie Stahl joins us for this Forum Hour, a correspondent and co-editor for 60 Minutes. She covered both the White House and the world for decades and was CBS News White House correspondent during the Carter, Reagan, and first Bush administrations, as well as serving as moderator of Face the Nation. She recently published a book about grandmothering titled Becoming Grandma, and we welcome her to the Forum program. Delighted to have you here.
I'm thrilled to be here, and I should say right up front that I'm having a professional catastrophe because I have laryngitis, and I hope everybody can hear me.
There are some who say it sounds sexier.
Does it?
Yeah, some say that.
As opposed to someone who's got laryngitis?
You sound fine to me.
Good. Okay.
And we actually met back in 1999 when your book came out, Reporting Live. We did an event at a Brentano's bookstore, and I was a little brokenhearted when you didn't remember that. But, you know, you realize as you go through the years in this business, especially with people who do lots and lots of interviews, there's nothing that memorable about the interlocutor, although my sister was there and she sent her good wishes to you because at the time you weren't even imagining either one of you that you'd be grandmothers.
And here so your sister's are. A grandmother.
She is.
Is she a granny nanny?
A granny nanny.
A granny nanny is a grandmother.
You got to define that.
Who takes care of the grandchildren 2 days a week, or maybe 3 or 4 days a week. And I call them granny nannies because they take all the duties over of a regular nanny.
Well, grandparents are spending a lot more time these days than they did even a decade ago. That's in your book, about seven times more. I mean, there's a lot of this
well,
kind
that's
of
the
research.
Money. They're spending seven times more money on their grandchildren than they did just 10 years ago. And that's because our kids need our help. They need us to help babysitting because child care is so expensive. And they just need a little help with not toys, but, you know, buy the crib, buy the car seat. And really, grandparents across the country.
Let me reassure you, your voice sounds fine, by the way.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah, you know, you were the epitome of self-control, I mean, as you write about this experience. I have a friend, Nikki Meredith, who talked about grandparent lust. She wanted to have a grandchild. You, I suppose, wanted to have a grandchild like anyone else. But when you had this grandchild, Jordan, and there was another, Chloe, your multi-para grandparent now, there was a jolt and a sensation that you had never experienced, a more intense love than you ever could have imagined.
Yeah, and while everybody always tells you that becoming a grandparent's the best thing, you don't understand. It's impossible to understand how different this emotion is. It feels deeper. It feels total body. There's a surge, a sort of blaze of elation. And I was so surprised by it and taken aback by it that I wanted to find out what that was. And do most grandmothers go through that? And I found out that they do. And a lot of grandmothers hearing me right now are saying to themselves, yes, I had that.
And of course, you've heard probably many times you don't look like a grandmother. I don't know what a grandmother looks like. I remember interviewing Gloria Steinem and said, this is what 80 looks like. You know? That's what a grandmother looks like. You are a grandmother, and congratulations on that. And different relationship with your daughter and your grandchild and your grandchildren, for example, then you had, you're right about having, you don't go into detail, but you're right about having some rancor with your mother. And your mother was dying, actually, when your first grandchild was born, right?
First, let me go back to, you don't look like a grandmother. Baby boomers have spent many years trying to stay young. And grandparents today are baby boomers. I mean, that's baby boomers are now 50 to 70, and they've spent their lives trying not to look whatever age they were. So we're just continuing that through this phase. But yes, I think, I mean, my situation is my situation, but in terms of my mother and my daughter. But the big thing that I realized is that we grandparent in a completely, totally 180 degree difference from the way we parent. When we parent, we feel a responsibility. We feel a fear, actually, that we're going to forget something about the child, or they're going to get sick, or whatever the fear is. We're also policemen. Keep them in line.
The old cliche is it's much easier to be a grandparent because you don't have that day-to-day constant concern and anxiety.
Yeah, but why don't we? It just is. It's as if it's genetically woven in that when we become grandparents, we just concentrate on that little creature. There's nothing else going on in the room. There's no distraction. You're focused on that person, that little person, in a delicious way. It's as if you're in a zone with the baby.
It's funny you say delicious because I'm always struck by this kind of what I call almost cannibalism of grandparents. I want to eat that child up, you know, this sort of thing.
That's good.
This has been an extraordinary experience for you. I mean, you write about it with verve and with a great deal of feeling and certainly communicate just how important it was to you. And, you know, you've had an extraordinary career. I mean, as a news correspondent, as a news reporter, and as an anchor and so forth. And yet, this kind of tops it all, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, it does. Because it just feels wonderful. And I went about writing the book and researching the book as a 60 Minutes correspondent. So the first thing I found out was that that feeling is actually a biochemical feeling. When mothers have babies, their brains are rewired and different hormones start secreting. Mothers know this. Their personalities change. Grandmothers also have a physiological change that goes on. And we secrete bonding hormones with that little baby. And a lot of this enormity of emotion is actually coming from within us in a total body way, just the way I felt it. It wasn't something that was in my mind. It was my body reacting to the baby. And of course, affecting my mind because it was elating. I was secreting bonding hormones, but obviously happy hormones, clearly. And grandmother, and that goes on. It's not just the first time you hold them. It goes on from that moment on every time you see them, every time you hug them.
Talking with Leslie Stahl, who has been on 60 Minutes for a quarter of a century on her latest investigation, becoming a grandmother, and was White House correspondent for many years for CBS News as well. And by the way, the subtitle is The Joys and Science of the New Grandparent. And you do get into a lot of the sciences you just alluded to, but also talking to a lot of other grandparents, Whoopi Goldberg and Ellen Goodman and Diane Sawyer and Tom Brokaw, and also taking into account the changes, not only because of what you call the boomer generation, but the economic changes that you alluded to, but other changes that have taken place. In fact, Diane Sawyer, whom I mentioned before, is an interesting example because she has this bond that you mentioned, despite the fact that Mike Nichols' grandchildren are not her biological grandchildren.
Right. And she speaks of those, her step-grandchildren, in exactly the same language that I speak of mine. And that was one reason I agreed to do the book, because I knew there'd be a second sort of avenue to go down that had nothing to do with me, and that would be the joys of step-grandmothering. Excuse me. I was so taken by my many girlfriends who are step-grandmothers, all talking about that jolt of emotion, and they had theirs before I had mine, and it was in my head. Wow, that's so interesting. There are also surrogate grandmothers who have no real connection, no familial connection, who go through it too.
And when you're talking about the science, too, it does stave off dementia. We know that, don't we?
Yes. There are studies, more very recent studies, that say if you take care of your grandchild or a small child who you feel connected to, dementia will – you'll hold it off.
Other – and your husband, whom I interviewed many years ago, Aaron Latham, whom people know from Urban Cowboy and other – works that he authored, had Parkinson's, and for a while there was a diminution of symptoms when he became a grandparent?
Yeah. Well, grandfathers go through a wide range of changes as well. And in my husband's case, he all his symptoms went away. It was very strange. And we try to find out what had happened. Maybe didn't have Parkinson's. One doctor said he might have had West Nile virus. Oh, please. That, I didn't believe that for 1 minute. But all the symptoms went away. One doctor said there's such a thing as disease vacation. You get a little vacation from whatever your degenerative disease might be. Of course, his came back. But for about a year, it seemed as though he was cured. It was very peculiar. And I, Dr. Stahl here... I say it's because he became a grandfather, and it was so explosive in a slightly different way from what I went through, but so meaningful and big in terms of outlook on life, that's what produces
180 degrees change. Different than parenting. That's how you describe it.
Because we turn from being strict, we turn to mushballs. The word no is disabled somehow. It just vanishes from our vocabulary. We can't say it. If a grandchild says to his or her grandmother, no matter what the parent said, I want to play on the iPad. Mommy has just said no. Granny will say, sure, come on, sit on my lap.
Yeah, but this causes, and you write about this in your book, there are problems with parents trying to be too interfering. There are problems, in fact—
Grandparents being too interfering.
With grandparents, I'm sorry. And some of them get banished and rationed in terms of their time as a result, yeah.
This was the most painful thing I came across. It shocked me. It hurt me. That there are situations where grandparents are not allowed to see their own grandchildren. Now, there may be a couple of cases where it's justified. Let's say the grandparent is a violent person. Okay. But we're talking about people you and I know in our lives. And, I mean, it's almost a criminal thing to say to a grandparent, you cannot see that little person. Because that little person becomes the most important things in our lives, most important thing to us as grandparents, the most important thing. And to say that, no, you're banished.
We're talking with Leslie Stahl.
The worst punishment, and a lot of these grandparents have no idea what they did wrong. It hurt me to hear these stories.
Well, it's hurtful. I'm sure it's very hurtful to the people who go through these things, and the stories are hurtful to read, frankly.
The most shocking of all these shocking stories was what happened with the 9/11 grandparents. Some of them are not allowed to see their grandchildren, and so they lost a child, and now they can't see the grandchildren.
Brings up the whole question also. I know some people who were barred legally as part of the divorce seeing their grandparents. And should grandparents have legal rights? I mean, you get into that whole sort of thorny, vexing territory.
Well, in some states, not all, but some states, grandparents can sue for visitation rights. You can go to a family court. But if they win those rights, they always have to have a social worker in the room with them, with their grandchildren.
Again, our guest is Leslie Stahl, White House correspondent for CBS News and correspondent for 25 years for 60 Minutes. Her new book is Becoming Grandma, and it's obviously new territory and exciting territory, and makes me this is kind of a little bit of a segue, but there was your movement into the chair that you moved into. And I'm thinking of the chair specifically because it actually had female on it, right?
Oh, that chair. I mean, this was... Okay, that chair.
I mean, you were a pioneer, and you and in those days, for a woman to be, you know, we're talking about even before, I guess, Barbara Walters was anchoring, right?
That's a good question. Yeah, But she was there first.
No, she was before you. I know, yeah,
but she then before she was anchoring.
But
yes.
You were breaking new ground. I don't know. You know Belva Davis. You know who was the first. She's a local anchor for many years here and reporter for NBC, our local affiliate. She's the first African American woman to be an anchor, essentially, and a major reportorial duties. But we're talking about a period when women were just not part of the old boys' fraternity. They just had to get in.
I can remember going back to when CBS hired me, affirmative action, which was very popular in the early 70s, had just come into force for the networks. And I got a call from a friend of mine at all three networks saying they're desperate for women. And I was a reporter in Boston at the time. And he said, "This is your moment. Go and apply." And they were. They'd put out a memo saying the next people you hire will be women and minorities. And I was swept into that movement, but I was early, and there weren't many of us at all. I mean, in the entire profession, I went to Washington. But, you know, women have always been attracted to journalism. There have always been a few, and they've always stood out.
Well, now they stand out with great distinction, one might add, and have for decades now, as you have. Wondering, this is kind of an offbeat question, but when you think about your grandchildren, and you've said things, I've read recent statements that you've made showing feelings of disconcerting nature about the way the election campaign is going and the way things are moving in our national institutions, and many, of course, share those feelings. And then, you know, we're talking about climate change in the last segment, and you think, is this the kind of world I want, ISIS and so forth, for my grandchildren, whom I adore and whom I'm so bonded with and so forth? I mean, does that enter into your skull?
All
and if so,
the time.
How?
Yeah. All the time. I'm constantly thinking, what kind of a world will my grandchildren be in when they're adults? And will they want to even bring children into that world? I think about it all the time. Where will they live? Will they be living in the North Pole? Because it's the only place that'll be, have air that you can actually breathe. Where will we grow vegetables when there's global warming everywhere? I think about that. I think about the politics of the United States, the paralysis that we're living through. And, you know, at the same time, Michael, because you and I've been around this long, I think of 1968. And in 1968, there was the same sense of gloom and doom.
We had assassinations, yeah.
Yeah, we had rioting. We had Nixon. We were about to have Watergate. We had the Vietnam War. We had class warfare in the streets. And there was a lot of polarization over politics, conservatives and liberals. You know, maybe we just forget how bad it was back then.
You don't. You covered Watergate.
I
don't.
I can't remember if it was worse than it is now. Of course, when you live it, it's always a heightened feeling. But back then, things were pretty, pretty bad.
But you've commented. In fact, I read a talk that you gave recently up in Santa Rosa. You were talking about technology altering the way we live and communicate. And
yeah, that worries me too.
People are scared. They're uninformed. You said in these remarks that addressed this audience, lots of things to worry about. But in the meantime, when you're with these grandchildren,
yeah, goes away.
It just melts, huh?
Everything. Everything just it's like fairy dust when I'm with them. And grandparents, and I've talked about this with the women and the men I interviewed, that focus on the grandchild when you're in their presence is so intense. I don't know. I think almost every time I walk into a room when my grandchildren are not there, I'm aware of everything that's going on around. I'm there. I'm concentrating. But I know who else is in the room. I know what else is going on. Sometimes I'm going through the list. What do I have to do today? Those grandchildren, there's only one thing, and it's them. And there were so many things I despised doing with my daughter. I hated the park. Oh, my gosh. And that was her favorite place to go. And I had to drag myself to the park. mommy push me on the swing. Oh, my God, don't make me push you on the swing, I would say to myself. I am in the park with those grandchildren so joyously. Oh, push me on the swing. Sure. Higher. Sure. It's just we marvel at ourselves. We don't know who we've become.
Well, speaking of the joy, I mean, your daughter has a condition I never heard of before. I mean, she is happy most of the time under most circumstances. They actually have a name for this?
They do. She was such an easy...
Hyperthymia? How do you pronounce
Hyperthymia.
I've never heard of it, yeah.
She was such an even-tempered kid, even in her teenage years, that I began to worry. I thought, you know, she must be repressing. No kid is that happy and sunny and even all the time like this. So I said to my husband, we need to bring her to a psychiatrist. And he said to me, what? You're going to take her to a psychiatrist and say, my child's too happy? Are you kidding me? So I went and I described her to a psychiatrist and he laughed and he said, you know, there are people like that. You don't hear about them because they never go to a doctor. They're not studied. But in terms of happy, sad, there's a bell curve. And some people are always unhappy. And they're depressed. And most of us are in the middle. Some days good, some days bad. And then at the other end are these people with hyperthymia.
I think they call it set points often, or temperament or something along those lines. Your relationship with your own daughter, Taylor, was really a very good one. And obviously that has translated into the relationship with grandchildren. But I'm wondering about something else. And I was thinking about people who have passed on, who you worked with, who were really, you know, very important people in your life, people like Mike Wallace and Bob Simon, you know.
Andy Rooney.
It must be a feeling
Ed
sometimes.
Bradley.
Like we could go on, and not only that, but your mother and all the grandchildren don't get to know these people. They don't get to really have any interaction with them. And that must seem like a kind of vacancy, doesn't it?
It's interesting. It doesn't. I mean, life goes on. You think about your own grandfather. My grandmother died when I was young on my father's side. My grandfather lived near us. And life goes on. I'm what he was when I was a little girl. It's strange. But life marches on.
Did your mother really take you by for clothes for you till you were 35?
Oh, yeah.
That's true.
And I did everything she told me to do till I was 35. First, she told me not to have children. That wasn't pleasant to hear, but she did. She told me not to. So I didn't have children. Then I turned 35. She said, oh, I made a mistake. You should have children. And I had one by the end of that year. Oh, yeah. I did everything she told me.
Talking again with Leslie Stahl, correspondent for 60 Minutes. Her new book is Becoming Grandma, The Joys and Science of the New Grandparenting. And I think there are many grandparents who, not only grandmothers, but grandfathers who probably want to weigh in here and talk about your own experiences and how it may have changed your life. And maybe ask a question to listeners. What's the most surprising thing about being a grandparent? Or you may just want to join us talking with Leslie Stahl, an opportunity to talk to really one of our leading news journalists who has been in the business for a long time. want to talk about 60 Minutes? Want to join us? Toll-free number is yours, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum@kqed.org. Or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Leslie Stahl, who has been with 60 Minutes for 25 years, talking about her latest investigation, which is having become a grandmother, and she is certainly excited about that, sharing that excitement in a book which is called Becoming Grandma, The Joys and Science of the New Grandparenting, and there's a lot more in it than just her own experiences. In fact, the first question I have here is from a listener named Rosella who says, the premise of the book sounds white Anglo-Saxon. Is there an inclusion of ethnic and cultural differences? My black Southern grandmother certainly knew how to say no.
Well, it depends on how involved they are in actually raising the kids. If I find that if the granny nanny is there 5 days a week, then she becomes the disciplinarian, and the mother who's out working, if there is a mother, becomes the permissive one, and the roles change. I have a girlfriend who, a grandmother girlfriend, who moved to help her daughter with the kids. And my friend takes care of the kids 5 days a week. And then the mother works very hard. When she comes home, she's the one who gives them candy and lets them play with the iPad. And the grandmother says, don't do that. It's role reversal. I also have a chapter in the book called A House in the Bronx. I came upon this building by chance. It was constructed by the city of New York for grandmothers and great-grandmothers who are taking care, who have custody, actually, of the children. And the building is all minorities. It's African-American and Hispanics. And what's so wonderful about the building is that the city gives the grandmothers and great-grandmothers services. They go to class to learn how to deal with an unruly teenager. They go to nutrition classes, and they help the kids with homework. It's just perfect. And I was told there's no building like this anywhere else, and there should be, because grandparents across the country, and this is not exclusively a minority issue, grandparents are raising children everywhere, and it's a growing phenomenon. And there's no public policy to deal with it, and there should be. I did another chapter on surrogate grandparents, and that's a whole other issue. But yes, there's quite a bit about minorities in the book, to answer the question directly.
Another question from Katerina says, have you seen any differences in what it's like to be a grandparent if your daughter is a single parent?
I know one case. I won't say who. But I know one case where this young, she wasn't so young anymore. She was getting past the child-rearing years. There was no man in her life. So she picked out a sperm donor, someone she knew, and had a baby. And her parents moved out for about 3 months just to help her start the process. Because it's very difficult when the baby's a firstborn if there's only two hands. You need at least four, possibly eight. Just in the beginning. But here's the story. The mother of the donor, has gotten involved. And she's mm-hmm. become somewhat of a granny nanny. Yes, there's a little bit about the single mother who really needs the grandparents more than the married couple. All kids today really need us. But single mothers most particularly, because if they're working, they're worrying about child care, and that is exorbitantly expensive. Good child care can cost as much as college. And so one of the things I come around to in the book, I call it a call to arms, that grandparents should be more involved with babysitting, more involved. And if young parents don't want their parents around that much, they should suck it up, because it'll help them financially. It'll help them with childcare. And babies need their grandparents. They have an atavistic, lifelong, human history long, need to have their grandparents in their lives.
It's atavism, huh?
It's atavism.
We're going to go to our calls here. I just had to read a funny comment by a listener named Martin who says, grandparents and grandchildren have the same enemy, so they are natural allies. That's a different spin on things. By the way, you had an interview not that long ago with Scalia before he died, and I just wanted to touch that because he had a whole passel of grandchildren, I know, and as
not
many
to
people
mention
did,
a whole passel of children.
Yeah, but, well, one yeah. begets the other of them. But, you know, there was you had a response to them that many people have, for that matter, Ruth Bader Ginsburg has had with a long friendship. You found him hilarious and charming and amicable and all that, despite
all of that.
His rigidity and despite his obviously ossified attitudes.
There's nobody you'd want to have lunch with more, dinner with more. It was kind of a bon vivant, you know? And he knew lots of things about lots of subjects. We got to be almost friends, and then I interviewed him. And he was tough. Man, he was tough. He knew what he knew.
We're going to go to our calls. Let me bring first caller on here. And, John, that's you. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Good morning.
directly with you, Leslie. You don't know it, but we go way back to the time when you were the anchor for Face the Nation, and I think you are still the best anchor Face the Nation ever had.
You've won my heart.
Well,
totally
you won my heart a long time ago. And I want you to know how important I think 60 Minutes is to the American life. There is no other news program like 60 Minutes, and it's absolutely a necessity in our country. And you, 60 Minutes did two extremely important shows last night, one on money and politics and one on drugs. And I'd like you to address the drug issue, maybe from the vantage point of a grandmother, and tell us what more, what are we missing here? Why are we continuing to have such a difficult problem with the drug issue? Why are our young people going on drugs, and what can we do to persuade them not to do it?
How do you see that, Leslie Stahl?
Yeah, John, that's so huge. You know, I'll address it, but I'm not a policy person, with good reason. I find these issues, all the ones that you've raised and many more, just intractable. And I wouldn't be very good at finding solutions. I'm pretty good at reporting on what the problem is. Solutions are tougher. One of the problems on the drug side is that the costs of drugs, heroin, which is the problem today, have come way down. I mean, the drug dealers know exactly how to get people hooked. They play with the price. It costs nothing. And they get the people hooked. And then that, and that's why it perpetuates. And it's age old. Certainly my lifetime.
Let me thank John for his call. And you doing okay there?
A little coffee.
All right. Let me get another caller on. That's David. David, join us. Morning.
Hello to both of you. I would like to ask Ms. Stahl if she would please investigate our new botched Bay Bridge. From beginning to end, the construction of this bridge has been marred with mistake after mistake after mistake, fraud. It's all been reported in the Chronicle. Your host can acknowledge what I'm saying. It's exasperating for a number of reasons that we spent all this money and there were all these mistakes, but also because no one's been held accountable. And it really, you know, is this normal for major construction? Because it doesn't seem that way.
Well, David, let me cut to the chase here because it is a big story here in the Bay Area. But would it appeal to 60 Minutes? There have been some real botches, as he said. We've featured it on this program.
I hear your passion. And I'm remembering a story I did, gosh, maybe 10, 12 years ago, on the Big Dig in Boston. And it was the same thing. It was a series of bridges. Excuse me, my voice is bad. It was a series of bridges. And it was exactly what you're saying. Overcost, mistakes. I stood on a ramp that went nowhere. It just stopped. They stopped it. So it was just hanging out there way up high. The corruption was unbelievable. The disruption to different communities was unbelievable. So it is not, I gather, a unique situation to San Francisco.
How do stories come to 60 Minutes? How do you decide on what story to do? And so it has to have a national punch to it, doesn't it?
Well, I like it when it has a national punch myself. The joy, one of the many joys of 60 Minutes, is that we find our own stories. There's a responsibility there to come up with good stories, but we have to search for them either in local newspapers, foreign newspapers. People call. People send in by mail little précis of what they think we should cover.
Do something on grandmothers on 60 Minutes?
I did something on grandmothers on Sunday morning. And I'll tell you something, they sell books. I had a big spike after that show. Getting back to the infrastructure, first of the main problem, the bigger problem in my mind is that we are not fixing our infrastructure. And now what you're saying is when a city does and you have it here. I know about the Boston one. I'm sure it's true all over the country. When we finally invest in a project of major scope like this, we mess it up. I don't know about your cost overruns. It was hideous in Boston. Are you experiencing that
as
well?
Had cost overruns, yeah. And there have been just really serious mistakes. And as I said, it was a big story here. It's an ongoing big story. I want to actually read a funny remark by Henry, who says, "I'm not a grandparent or even a parent, but I am subjected to unending tales of my friends' allegedly fascinating grandchildren. I couldn't care less. Mean as that sounds, I think grandparents need to consider their audience before inflicting grandkid stories on them."
Oh, I agree with you. I totally agree with you. I try to be careful. One of my best friends really doesn't like children. She jokes about it, but it's true. So I'm very aware of what you're talking about, Henry, and I agree with you. We don't have to inflict our particular joy on everybody else around the world.
Here's Henry joining us from Menlo Park. Here's Wynn joining us from Menlo Park. Wynn, welcome. You're on
Thank
the air.
Thank you. A quick time. I have two granddaughters who are 10 and 7, and ever since they were young, I would write down all the funny things they say and do. I'm up to page 61, and the girls love to hear the kind of things that they said and did when they were kids. The second thing we do is we do family plays. We write a play every 3 months when we go back to New York, and the girls act in the play and really throw themselves into it. And the last thing, quickly, is that Michael started me writing a book about my life, and I told my granddaughter I was going to do this. And I'm up to page 554, and she says, "Can I read it?" So you have to do things that your kids will focus on, your grandkids, and write things down for them so they can remember.
Yeah. Those are fabulous. I've actually written them down because I like those ideas. But I can hear the joy in your voice when you are madly in love with your grandchildren.
And good luck with that book, Wynn.
Yeah.
Wynn took a class.
I think you need
a
little editing there.
Let me get another caller on. Chris, we'll go right to you. Hi.
Hi, how you doing? My comment was actually more was about my father-in-law, and he unfortunately passed away last year. And my wife and I had our first child, and was their first grandchild. And he was, you know, he's kind of an old surfer guy, and he's kind of set ways. But you know, he watched. You know, we have a kind of a grandparents nanny where they watched him through the week as my wife and I have to work. But the profound change that it made in him and in their lives was absolutely amazing. Like I said, he was kind of set in his ways, and he did what he did, but nothing changed him more than our son. And what really kind of gets me, you know, what kind of hurt me is that he adored our little guy so much that, you know, that Hayden never really got to really know him.
Mm.
And it was cut short. But, you know, just the change and the effect it had in him was absolutely profound. And, you know, my wife, my mother-in-law were just completely blown away. Like, nothing changed him more than what our little guy did. And it was very profound.
I came upon this phenomenon that you're talking about. The effect on grandfathers of these little kids is very different from grandmother, but can be what you're saying. Life-altering. I write about Bob Simon, my colleague, the unfortunately, sadly, painfully died in a car accident. But he had a depression, and when his grandson Jack was born, he popped out of the depression. That little baby brought him right out of it, and I was so taken by that I began to interview psychiatrists after I started to write the book to see. If there was a commonality in what you're talking about and what I watch with Bob Simon, and the psychiatrist said yes, it has been documented that if grandfathers take care of babies and they are depressed, listless, bored with their lives, they will pop out of it. And as you kept saying, it's a profound change. Grandfathers definitely go through it. And I have a whole chapter on grandfathers for the very reason you were talking about.
And again, our guest is Leslie Stahl, and let's get a grandfather on here. Gary, that's you. Good morning.
Good morning, Ms. Stahl. What you said about your husband with Parkinson's, I have Parkinson's, and I hadn't seen my daughter and my grandson for about 8 years, and they visited in August, last August, And my Parkinson's symptoms were a little bit better.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, and I'm a baby boomer. I'm going to be 70 years old, but I have all my hair, and it's professionally colored.
But I want to tell you something. What's your name?
Gary.
Gary. My husband started to box. Boxing is a phenomenon for Parkinson's. It deals with all the symptoms, the stiffness, the balance, the strength, and mainly your outlook. There's a program, Boxing for Parkinson's. You have to see if there's one near you and just try it. Try it once.
Did you happen to see the front line that our colleague Dave Iverson, who used to do the show on Friday, he had Parkinson's. In fact, it was in his, it's kind of a Norwegian hereditary. His father had it, his brother had it. And he did a whole frontline special on people who go dancing with Parkinson's. And somehow they're dancing. It's like when you have people who have some dementia remembering words and lyrics to songs like Oliver Sacks has written about. They can dance.
Well, boxing is in that same category. Yeah. But boxing adds the strength dimension and the camaraderie of the group that these Parkinsonians box with. It's a whole program. It was designed just for Parkinson's. And my husband's symptoms have really been alleviated by this. He goes 3 nights a week.
He can beat people up now, too, right? He's a pugilist. Gary, thank you for the call. Let me read some more comments. Here's a story from Charles who says, "We're a two-dad San Francisco family here with a daughter we adopted the day she was born. After grandparenting 4 of my brother's kids in Washington, D.C., my mom, Ruth, retired and moved to San Francisco to help with our then 4-year-old daughter. She stayed 10 years until dementia became too severe. My mom died last fall, and we lived so much of what Leslie Stahl says. I use this as a thanks to my mother for giving herself to 5 grandchildren in ways no one else could."
Yeah, but let me tell you something. That was not a sacrifice. She spent the last third or however long of her life, the last 10 years of her life, doing exactly what she wanted to be doing. I promise.
Julia writes, "I was one of the lucky parents who had 2 great kids, and when they had kids, those grandchildren walked straight into my heart without asking, and lo and behold, I found they belonged there. It was as if they had been there all along."
Ooh, I love that.
And here's Diane who writes, "I'm a 52-year-old woman who never had children. It wasn't until I adopted my dog and felt that maternal thing that I was sad and I never had a child. Now you're telling me that there's something even more wonderful, more joyful, grandparenthood, that I will never know. Any words of comfort for me, Leslie?"
Well, I will tell you that one of my dearest friends is an aunt, a great aunt. And she is like a grandmother to those children. And she complained to me that I didn't write about that. She said, "You wrote about everything about grandmothers except this." And I have met many an aunt who takes on that role and that coloration. So I don't know about this woman. Did she give her name? Diana?
Diana, yeah. I believe, yeah.
I don't know if she has siblings, but if they have kids, plunge in. Be an Auntie Mame.
Let's plunge in a little bit to journalism here, because I'm looking at some questions from listeners. Dominic, for example, says, "Is the newspaper dead?" And another listener writes, "What does Leslie think about how news has become more commentary than news?" And one might add, maybe more entertainment, too.
Right. Well, let's do the newspaper dead. I do think that we are inexorably moving to a society where we don't read things in paper form. And I think we're also moving inexorably to a society where we don't even use paper money. And we're going to save all those trees we've been chopping down. Everything, I think, will eventually be done online, even though there's a move back to books, you know, slight return.
Move, yeah.
But I just think
the average newspaper reader is what now is about 57 years old. I mean, it's the whole shift demographically.
We still want to read the news. It just won't be in paper form.
Yeah, it's underneath the TV screen going back and
forth. Yeah, the one little line. I don't know. I think that we see, for example, on 60 Minutes, because our ratings are so strong, that there is an appetite for serious journalism, the old-fashioned kind. But I just think over time, fewer and fewer people will be reading the actual newspaper, but news is not dead. Now, going to more commentary, you know, this is sort of a function of the fact that we have so many news outlets now, not just cable television, but now on the internet. There must be a million different news outlets. And when that happens, each one does present, come from a position. So that's kind of a natural progression as well. When the United States first came into being, there were many, many newspapers, and they all came from a different political perspective. And we're getting back to that in a way. You needed to have these big, huge, national kind of outlets with huge audiences, big newspapers, and network news shows where there was no cable back in those days, where everybody watched, where we abided by the rule that we were objective. And that's going away because of the splintering and the polarization. But let me say that 60 Minutes is still there, and we still abide by those old rules. The most important thing in our stories still is that they are objective and that we tell both sides. Now, my daughter says that she doesn't like that. She wants to know where we're coming from. Yeah, yeah, she said,
well,
come
I
on.
Hear the same thing. I mean, we try to avoid editorializing, and people want to know. What do I think, and so forth. But, you know, as a 60 Minutes correspondent, I want to get to more callers here. I have to ask you about Don Hewitt. He's such a controversial character. Many say, you know, a genius and so forth. He was a guy behind the scenes for many, many years. He was 60 Minutes. A lot of people, you know, thought he was kind of a ruthless, rotten character, too. I mean,
really?
You know, yeah. I just wonder what your verdict is. You're smiling. You liked him.
Well, of course I liked him. He hired me and he helped me. He was a genius. He could look at a story that ran 15 minutes. He'd never seen it before. And without taking any notes, he would then fix it just by telling you, move the end to the beginning and the middle to the end. And he had that kind of a genius. He was also a serious newsman. And he's the one you mentioned, entertainment. He is the first to say, you know, news doesn't have to be boring. News can be kind of entertaining. So he's the one who introduced that whole idea.
The idea of infotainment.
He did.
A word that I used to cringe when I heard, but not so much anymore, perhaps, because it's real. It's so pervasive. It's ubiquitous, in fact.
Well, but I think that at 60 Minutes, we do abide by all the old journalistic rules, because he was a serious newsman. But we do tell a story in a way that the old-fashioned newspapers didn't. You know, we don't have a lead. We tell a story. And that's the best way to get information out, is to tell a story.
Let me get some more callers on, and we'll go next to Sumit. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. I just, on the topic of grandmothers, I wanted to throw in a factoid. And this is about orcas, killer whales. Basically, they are one of the few mammals that go through a menopause.
Yes.
They don't die off after the period of sexual maturity. And the reason, the evolutionary reason for that is, in their society, grandmothers play a very vital role.
Now, you are a science buff, because when I say the science of grandmothering, that is one of the things I discovered, what you just talked about. There are only two other animals where females live after they can no longer reproduce. All the other animals, including the other primates, the apes and the gorillas and the chimps, when the female can no longer reproduce, out she goes, sits under a tree and dies. Whales, elephants, and humans live beyond menopause, have a menopause. And the reason is specifically to take care of the babies. Grandmothers are here to help raise babies. And, you know, I believe that when we don't, when we live too far away or our children won't let us, we actually ache, because it is, getting back to your favorite word, an atavistic need to be in those babies' lives. And they need us.
See, I pause with atavism because it connotes to me kind of almost something primal, but in a very often aggressive way even, you know.
Oh, I don't think aggressive, but it is very primal, and I mean it in that way.
I know you do. Well, what were you talking about? You know, I want to eat that baby up. It's so cute and all that kind of thing. There's a little bit of atavism in there.
No,
let me get another
no.
caller in here quickly from Montero. Larry, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Leslie, I just wanted to offer my appreciation for something you did 20 years ago. You and I were sitting in the St. Petersburg, Russia airport after you'd done a story on Heart to Heart.
Oh.
And you and your husband were there, and my wife and I were there having, we've been longtime supporters of Heart to Heart, and I'm not sure I ever got a chance to thank you for a wonderful story about a wonderful group.
Larry, what's Heart to Heart, quickly?
Heart to Heart, basically, I was doing congenitive heart surgery on young children.
In Russia,
yeah. Less than 50 kilos, because they weren't allowed to have surgery, and we were the first ones. We brought heart surgery over, and we're saving kids left and right.
This was the Oakland Children's Hospital that did it.
And thank you for that call, and it must be nice to hear those kind of kudos still coming through.
And I do remember that story.
And kudos
vividly.
On your book. Thank you for being with us, spending this time with us. The book, again, Becoming Grandma, The Joys and Science of the New Grandparenting, Leslie Stone.
Good for Mother's Day.
And good to have you with us.
Thank you.
We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Our producers are Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.